Well, good morning. Once again. I wanted to introduce this little chant and ritual just to give us a little bit more structure around the Dharma talks, to situate it, to make it clear that this is what we're doing when we listen to a talk. Even if we don't really completely understand the chant, it's a little enigmatic, but if it's not really, because it's just about sitting, opening, receiving whatever arises. And in this moment, it's these words. So, but it helps us to structure, as with all of the structure of the retreat. And what's amazing is that the Japanese word that we use, sesshin, for retreat, means something like to gather, shin, which is heart, mind. So to gather together heart, mind. And it works on a group level, so all of these heart, minds come together, gather together. We're usually dispersed in our usual lives and activities. Countries, cities, houses, apartments, whatever we do, we gather together here. And it also applies on a micro level. Each of us, we come here to gather our dispersed minds and hearts, because we're usually so dispersed in all of our activities and busy being me, that we become distracted and dispersed. And so we come here to gather it together. And the structure helps us to do that gathering. Just like this structure of lighting incense, bowing, sitting down, waiting a moment, then chanting, also brings us here to what we're doing right now. In a different way than if we just take our chairs and sit on the terrace outside, which is also a great structure. It's just a different structure. We can do that as well at some point. So my point of reintroducing this chant is that to help us gather together what's dispersed. What is a paradox, however, is that the whole practice that we're doing here is about, it's almost like if we, gather together a bunch of kittens or rose petals, or, at weddings sometimes, they gather rose petals and then they throw them. Or you gather a bunch of kittens so that you can see them when you open up, they run in all the directions. Or we, we might gather something else to better see it fly away. Gather birds and then watch them fly away or something. So actually that's what we're doing here. Is we are gathering together, gathering what's dispersed, so that we can let it go. So that we can dismantle the whole thing. As you've heard me use this word a lot lately, dismantling. Disassemble. So gather it all together and then dismantle it all. So that we can awaken to this radical freedom of not being stuck, held together, with some center of identity that we think is me. Something like that. So first we have to do the gathering so that we can better disperse. We gather what's dispersed so that we can then disperse it. But in a different way. We're not dispersing it. The dispersing that is happening before we come, this is all very general and basic, but and it's much more subtle than that, actually. As the chant says, the meaning is really subtle. The dispersing that is happening when we're not doing what we do here, has to do with not knowing who I am, truly, not knowing what the center is. And so we feel isolated, we grasp for what we think might be me, we push away things we don't like, you know, so we don't want mosquitoes. We talked about this morning. We don't want mosquitoes. And so what can we do about that? Well, given our circumstances, we just close the windows, turn off the lights when the windows are open. You know, we know these solutions that we have. We might resort to, which unfortunately often happens, you know, spraying some powerful chemical to kill the mosquitoes, because they don't correspond to who we are and who we want to be and how we want the world to be. So we don't want mosquito bites, so we will kill them. And this is, you know, like this is the cut and dry solution. So we decided as a group, well, we close the windows. Same with the wild beasts that we don't want entering the apartment, the buildings, right? So we close the doors. The wild beasts probably wouldn't be very happy in the building anyway. This is something that we've added to their landscape, and it's not probably their native habitat, and they wouldn't be interested, but they would wander in there anyway, probably. So we close the doors. Now, all of these solutions, per se, that seem very obvious, they arise from our practice of, well, first of all, not knowing, meaning we let go of our fixed ideas of how things should be, of who we are and what the mosquitoes are and the wild beasts and the landscape in which we live. What we want and don't want, we let go of those ideas, and that allows us to open them to something else, because we're not limited by those ideas. And the perfect example, which I've been using since this situation arose here, is of this very retreat, because this was not what we planned. Okay, we weren't supposed to be here today. We were supposed to be somewhere else. And this is a perfect metaphor for life in general. It never happens like we think it will. We become used to things functioning in a certain way, but on very subtle levels, they don't function that way. And we're constantly making little adjustments. Whether it's breathing in and out, no two breaths are the same, and we're constantly adjusting to the air, to the level of our bodily activity. If we're walking fast, then we have to breathe more, or shorter breaths more quickly. If we're lying down, eventually our breath will settle in a different way. If we are, you know, recently in Paris, in France, as many of you know, there were, you know, big, huge riots and demonstrations, and so we had to, you know, wake up in the night and smell tear gas. We breathe differently when we experience that. We're constantly making these little adjustments without even really thinking about it. Our body is doing this, and we're thinking of it as my body. My body breathing. We'll get into that later, but so on. And this is on a little different level of, okay, so we arranged to do something from 22 to 29 July in a certain place, and for a variety of circumstantial reasons that couldn't happen. And all of the circumstances that led to that change of meaning it can't happen, we can't even get our minds around all of the reasons why. Because if we know very basically that we didn't have enough people to afford to pay the price that would be required to stay there. Very basic. But then we can start looking into, okay, well, why didn't we have enough people? Why did we book that place if we weren't going to have enough people? Why did we agree to that price? Why did we make it this week instead of next week? It's endless, all of the different circumstances of why it happened. What do we do when the situation, when everything changes? We might panic. We might have these ideas about, oh, we have to cancel. We might become very anxious and worried and fearful, angry, upset because the people who we were counting on coming aren't coming, all kinds of reasons we can, reactions we can have. But instead, what we did, of course, we went through this, and I'm saying we because there's pretty much Thiago, João, and me, and mostly them, but of course we went through those emotions and those things, but very quickly there was an opening to not knowing. Okay, I don't know. I don't know. What should we do? We didn't know what to do. And that allows us better then to, what we say, bear witness to the circumstances, to better see the situation. And to open, it becomes very spacious then, when we don't have fixed ideas about it. So then it opens up to, okay, well, maybe we'll go somewhere else. Quickly, the idea of canceling was not an option. That we decided that that was not what we wanted to do. But we opened to that, that possibility was there of canceling, of saying, okay, but then what would be all the circumstances of that, the consequences of that, and we decided we didn't want that. I decided, I didn't think they agreed, but I was really the one who said, no, we're not canceling. And then open to all of the possibilities, because we had let go of the our fixed ideas about the situation and all of the emotions we had around it, we were able to open much wider and have much more space to see what to do. And we weren't attached to being angry or fearful or anxious or guilty or whatever the emotions were. And then some various options came up because we opened up. Even some places to potentially have retreats arose that we didn't know about. And that allows us to think in the future, oh, maybe we could go to those places. And Tiago's family offering this place arose. And when I heard the various options, of course, some of them weren't available, I liked this one best. After discussing with Tiago about it and making sure that his family was okay and would work and whatever. And the reason that I liked it the best was because it seemed to be the most organic. It seemed to be the, because I had let go of the ideas of what should be and should not be, how a retreat should be, where a retreat should be, how many people should be at a retreat, having let go of all of those ideas, and looking at the situation, looking at the number of people, the place, the region of Portugal where we had agreed to be, the necessary requirements to have a retreat, all of the different circumstances, this seemed like the obvious response. And this was in discussion with Tiago too, of how it could work. there were some, you know, questions about, you know, are there enough showers? Are there enough toilets? Will everyone have a bed? You know, all of these various questions. But if we let go of our ideas, which we did, just looked at the circumstances, bear witness to what is, then we had a better chance of taking action, and the action was, this is where we do it. And then, part of that action involved re-establishing the budget, so that meant that we could reduce the prices, and then the actions, other actions came of how do we get people here? What do we give to Tiago's family, because they're allowing us to be here? All then the consequences of that action. That's part of the whole action, actually. But we were able to do that because we had gone through this not knowing and bearing witness. And then the action really flowed quite naturally from there. Now, they may have another version of this story because they were more like intensely involved with it. But it was even, you know, before the questions of canceling or not, it meant looking clear-eyed, lucidly, as they were doing, at the registration and seeing at some point, I forget even when it was, maybe in May or June, I don't know.
A month before.
Yeah, a month before, saying, this ain't going to work. We need 20 more people and in 4 weeks, and we're not going to get it, you know. And so it involved, okay, letting go of our ideas about what that means, and then taking action from looking at that situation with clear eyes, instead of from attachments to how I want it to be, how I think it should be, blaming people because it's not like that. It involved even asking Naturaina if we could have different situation prices, whatever. A solution they proposed was to share the place with other people, that when we looked at that from the point of not knowing, bearing witness, that didn't work for us. So, it's actually a marvelous illustration of the whole practice, this situation. And yet, if we apply this to our life, to our being, it goes much, much deeper than that, and much more subtle. This is a perfect illustration of how it applies to concrete daily life, not abstract understanding of impermanence, not knowing, bearing witness, interconnection, interdependence, all of these concepts we have. This is like a, you know, hands-on, experiential thing of it, example of it, which is what our whole practice is about. That characterizes Zen practice. It's not about studying and conceptualizing. It's about dismantling all those concepts, throwing away all that learning, quote, and applying it, practicing it right here now in our daily lives. So I made some notes here so that I wouldn't forget stuff. So this, you know, I started out by saying, you know, the not knowing is about letting go of our fixed ideas about ourselves, basically. Oh yeah, good idea. Because it's this attachment to this identity center that we call self that isolates us from others, from the world, from what we call nature. I mean, we are nature as well. We're not separate from it, but we think of it as we're separate from it. So like we hear the rooster crow, And it's, you know, it's out there, over there, somewhere across the valley, or down the hill, or something. We hear it. I hear it. But actually, it's not separate from us. We see the you know, you see these pictures of people in Greece, you know, fleeing wildfires, and that's just one image. And that's just one issue of climate change, right? And we think of ourselves as being separate from what's happening, or we're like, we're suffering from it. It's outside of us, and we're suffering the consequences of whatever it is. It's hot, so there's fires, and our houses are being burned, and we run away from it. But actually, we're not separate from it. And our practice is about anchoring us, like I said, gathering us here together in this moment, in this practice of just basically observing the in and the out of breath, in order to then awaken to who we truly are, what we truly are, what our true nature is, and the nature of everything else, of the rooster, the mosquitoes, the oranges, the air, the water, the other, the paper in my book, the ink on the paper, to awaken to the true nature of it. That's what the whole point of the practice is. And when we do that, then, so if we can let go of our ideas about who we are, and then bear witness to what we see when we open like that, then that separation is reduced. That notion of being isolated from the others and from all things is reduced. And the more we do that, then the more and more that's reduced until, and there was this great quote I read somewhere of the practice, in the beginning of our practice, we discover that we are alone simply with the cosmos, with the universe. So we sit here, we watch our breath go in and out, and we eventually come to some notion of we're alone simply here with that, with the cosmos. Then, if we keep doing it, we come to alone simply as the cosmos, as the universe, as everything. And then, and this is even more subtle maybe, then it becomes cosmos alone simply with itself. So we go from, yeah, okay, I see that I'm here, but I'm just here with the cosmos. I'm aware of the cosmos, I'm saying cosmos as universe, or all things, or the 10,000 things, as we say. I breathe in, I breathe out, and I become aware that I'm not actually that breath. If I can observe it, how can I be it? You know, I'm not actually that thought, but I can observe it, and I am this. Eventually, we come to this empty presence, this empty awareness that observes. Okay, but the first thing is, okay, I'm just here alone with the cosmos, not alone in the sense of being cut off from everyone, but just being really present and aware of being here with the cosmos, with the mosquitoes and the flies and the rooster and the oranges and all the people sitting here and all of my thoughts and breath and everything, and all of their thoughts and breath and everything. Just here with it, with it. Then the next step is, then I am alone simply as it. So I am the cosmos. The cosmos is me. You know, this is when we talk about mu, this is what happens. We have an awareness of this. And then there's this even more subtle, where it's not even me and the cosmos, it's the cosmos simply alone as itself. And that's what this practice, when we come here and we gather all of this dispersed energy, activity, hearts, minds, thoughts, beliefs, when we gather it all here, and we gather it all here and sit, we open to that. We open to that possibility. We open to that spaciousness that allows us to experience that, because that's what it's about, is experiencing it. So if we come back to this notion of not knowing, it can lead to us re-examining, looking again at what we believe to be our center, our identity center. We always say, you're not who you think you are. First you have to look into who you think you are. And that's a fabulous, rich journey in itself, is looking into who you think you are. Looking into all of the ideas you have about yourself, all of the stories. So, we can look into, the story Tiago has told, the stories of this house, of this place, of his family here, in this house, in that house, in the other house, which we haven't been in, but we see it. Stories that, Tiago tells about his childhood here, and what a place of great freedom and rich experience it was for him here. And we can sense that. And the place is alive with those stories, with those histories. But that's not what the place is. That helps us to experience this place in a certain way. It focuses our attention in a certain way. But that's not what this place is. It doesn't mean that the stories don't exist, and that the memories, Tiago's memories and his family and the generations and the land that they work and the people that help them work it and all of that, that doesn't mean that that doesn't exist. But we can't reduce the place to that. Like, we can't reduce ourselves to that, to all of the stories we have, and all of the memories and the relationships, and the places we know, and the places we go, and the people we love, and the people we don't love, and all of that. We can't reduce ourselves to that. And the more that we look into it, the more we see that I am not just that. It's not so much I am not that, it's that I am not just that. And that changes then the way that we experience the world, the way that we move in the world, the way that we move with others, the way that we speak, think, feel, everything changes when we can open to this other possibility. So our week here is devoted to that. Our week is devoted to not knowing, to better awaken to things as they are. And that changes then, that changes how we behave, and how we behave then changes how we interact with people, and then their reactions change because our change. We can't even begin to fathom all of everything that is affected by our sitting here right now. Without judging it as being good or bad. Just witnessing it, bearing witness to it, and opening to the spaciousness of holding it all. Because actually life does not exclude anything. And everything is possible in this life, what we call life, but let's say the universe or something. Nothing is excluded. We exclude things, but nothing is excluded from it. So our practice is about opening and including, including and including, including. It doesn't mean that, so then immediately I hear the gears going in the mind already of, we don't act, we don't do anything, we just let things be as they are. Yes and no. So as we said, we take action. So our example of this retreat, of organizing this retreat, it did require taking some action. And we wanted to take action. And we wanted to take an appropriate action that worked with the number of people, the place, all of the circumstances. We didn't want to do something harmful. We didn't want to do something that was not within our resources. You know, we could have said, okay, we'll cancel and we'll reimburse everyone's travel expenses. That doesn't really satisfy anything. Doesn't satisfy our desire to have a retreat together, to come together. It doesn't satisfy our material resources, because we can't really afford that. That we maybe looked at those options, but that's not really what was appropriate action, given the circumstance. So it does not mean not doing anything. It means opening to the situation with the spacious mind and heart that allows us to see what's the appropriate action. So like with the mosquitoes, you know, if we pay attention to our precepts of non-killing, we don't kill the mosquitoes because we don't want them in the building. We close the windows so that they don't come in the building. And that's not really doing them any harm, and it's not doing us any harm, except maybe we'll be a little warmer than we were if we had the windows open. That was my experience last night. The window was open, there was mosquitoes, so I closed the window. It was okay. So again, including everything as it is does not mean not taking action. It might. Bearing witness might be bearing witness to our struggle to find a solution, to our anxiety about the situation that we don't like, that's painful. It might be our deep grief about loss. It might be our anger about the people who won't let us come for a cheaper price. I mean, could be anything, right? We bear witness to that as well. It doesn't mean not feeling it. It means really opening our hearts and minds to feel and hear and receive everything. Everything, not, then we can become totalitarian, but it means to open to whatever arises and to let things arise. It seems like it would make our life more difficult, but it actually makes our life much more easy to live in this. This is really radical liberation, to experience life like this. And when we talk about this practice being a practice of radical liberation, that's what we're talking about, is being open, aware, present, and then knowing how to act from that situation. And it's not a knowing, like intellectual knowing of having, you know, done the math, although that's part of it. Tiago did do the math to see the accounts, to see how much it would cost. First, how much we could not afford, and then how much it would cost if we came here. And we all benefited greatly from his not knowing, bearing witness, taking action, because the price is greatly reduced. So that's what our practice is this week here, not necessarily about this retreat, but it's just a really concrete example that we can all look at. And you can all find examples in your lives, always. Every moment here you can find an example of it, of letting go of a fixed idea. So the server comes in with food, you don't know what it's going to be. You have to let go of your ideas about when the server comes and you think, oh, I don't want that. You let go of your ideas about it's good or bad. Okay, I don't want that. It's not because it's bad or good, or wanting it or not wanting it is not good or bad. It's just, okay, I'm open to that. I bear witness to it, and then I act appropriately. We may be expecting pizza for lunch. Well, we won't have pizza for lunch. I really don't think we'll have pizza for lunch. but I may be surprised, right? we had sashimis in Adana in the old days where we did. So Michel Dubois would make pizza for lunch in Norioki. So we just never know, right? We have an opportunity to every moment here, but in every moment of our lives. But here, because we have this great structure, it helps us to be less dispersed. So our mind is more concentrated, more present. As the days go on, you will see that becomes even deeper and deeper, and you cultivate this really deep presence. If you pay attention, occasionally you'll wake up and you'll say, oh yeah, that's right, I am more present now. Even though it's like really, like I say, it's like walking in the wet grass. You don't realize that your shoes and pants are getting wet. But it is. You're getting wet here with more awareness, more presence, more concentration. And so that makes it easier then too. There's less white noise, maybe we say in English, white noise. I don't know how to say that in French. Is there a term like that?
Distractions?
What?
Distractions?
Yeah, you know, it's like this white noise is kind of like background noise. Sometimes we use the background noise to help us not hear other noise. as you know, yeah. And so this is even like taking away that background noise. Or it's not taking it away, but it's making it we're more aware then, and there's less of it, less of that background noise, so that we can see and hear more clearly. And therefore, we become more aware of our attachments. And we become more aware of, oh, it doesn't look like there's very many vegetables, so I better take a lot now because there won't be a second service. You know, things like this we do in Norioki, this weird kind of thing where we're planning ahead already for the second service when we haven't even started eating the first service. I forget where I read it in one of his books, the insight meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein talks about at one of his early retreats. In their practice, they don't do Orioki, but it's silent practice, and there's not much to hang on to. You know, they're very intense, those insight Vipassana retreats, and there's not much distraction to hang on to. So he said he would be waiting in line, and he would see what was being served, you know, up ahead. And he would already be angry at the person ahead of them because they were going to maybe get the last serving and he wouldn't get it. He wouldn't get, you know, it wasn't pizza, but it was something that he wanted, you know. And he would already have this whole story going on that the person ahead of him was going to get more than him, and he was already mad at them. And his practice helped him become aware of that and then helped him to let go of that, saying, this is crazy. Or Geno Roshi used to tell the story of her and her brother, one of her brothers, who were very close in age. You know, they were like a little over a year apart, I think. And always rivals. And Genno Roshi was her father's favorite, of course, daddy's little girl, you know. And her older brother was kind of, her middle brother, because she had another brother who was older, he was kind of the black sheep, mm-hmm. or that's how he felt in the family anyway. And so whenever, I think it was on, in those days they had, Thursdays was the half day off from school. Now it's Wednesdays in France, but at the time it was Thursday, kids didn't go to school. And so it was like pastry day. And so their mother would go to the pâtisserie and bring home pastries and put the plate there before. And her brother would always say to her, "Take whichever one you want because I know it's the one I want." So she would just take whatever it was. She kind of relished that. So she would take the éclair au chocolat because she knew that's the one he wanted. But it's this kind of thing, right? So we have this, already we're planning ahead. The other person will take the one I want. So we already had this thing of the one I want, what I want. And we're already planning ahead. So what would happen if she took the tarte au citron instead of the éclair au chocolat? Well, he maybe was so entrenched in it that he would have wanted the tarte au citron. I don't know, you know. So we have every moment here, we have a possibility to see this. And the ramifications, you know, the consequences are just endless. I mean, we can say they lead to the making of the atomic bomb, or the war in Ukraine, or all of the beautiful art that has been created. Every breath we take, every action we take has all of these consequences. We can't begin to see them. But we can begin to see, what am I here and now doing? Who am I and what am I doing? Become aware of it. And then we can become aware of the consequences of that, how I'm affected by it, and then how the others are affected by it. Becoming angry at the server because they're giving more fruit to the person next to you or something. Or you think they're giving more fruit. Or the server can be angry with the person who hasn't yet said stop. You know, like, keep shoveling it in there, you know. Or I noticed the servers were struggling with the big serving spoons they had. They could be like, you know, cussing out the person who gave them that big serving spoon. And we can become aware of this. And then what happens from that? What then? What do we do then when we open? Okay, I can let go of that. I can let go of my idea about how much fruit I should have. I can let go of what I want and what I don't want. It doesn't mean denying it. It means becoming aware of it and then not becoming attached to it. Like, you know, we could have all thought, oh yeah, we really would love to go to Natyurhana. It's such a beautiful place, and we had such great retreats there. It was so much fun last year, and there were so many people, and we had such a big celebration and all of that. And we don't want to let go of that. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it was over before it even started last year, you know? It never was in the way we think it was. So what was it someone posted on our WhatsApp? Freddie posted on our WhatsApp thread about in the beginning, what was it? In the beginning, nothing is. Anyone remember it? What? It was Freddie who posted it, yeah. I can't remember. It's from Nila Repa. Basically that in the beginning nothing is, in the middle nothing is, and in the end nothing is. But it's a little more poetic than that. But nobody remembers it, huh? Did nobody else read it? You saw it too, huh? Yeah. And it was referring to, it was in the thread of, that people had posted about our Dharma brother Mario dying. And Freddie was posting that in response to that, to, you know, mourning the death. And
do you want to...
the quote? Oh, you have the quote? Yeah, what is it?
Yeah. In the beginning nothing comes, in the middle nothing stays, in the end nothing goes.
Right.
We still have to act.
What? And you still... Oh yes, it does not discount acting at all. It does not.
Can I share something?
Yeah.
That's happening now. So Tiago and us put water in the pool, and so it's a place for the animals and the bugs and to drink, but at the same time it's a trap. And when I pass there, I go with this thing to pick up the bugs. And I just do that. It's something that I do. But now there's a lot of what is the name?
Asian wasps.
Yeah, Asian wasps there. Small ones, very small ones.
Mm-hmm.
So first I didn't realize that. So just pick it up. And then I saw the yellow. Oh. And now they are still sentient beings, but they are predators who don't have a predator, as Tiago said.
They don't have a predator?
No.
Oh.
And so what do I do? And I said, well, I'm going away. No, I can't go away. I already know that they are there. So I took them off. And now I don't know what to do, but I think that I will continue to, but it's a question. For me, it's a question, because they're sentient beings, but at the same time, well, I don't know what's the purpose. It's like I remember the movie, a Russian movie, where it was Go and See. At some point, a Russian soldier found an image of Hitler, and the image was going before and before and before until it was baby Hitler,
mm-hmm.
and he was. Oh, I can shoot that. It's like, it's not the same, but they're just babies, Asian wasps. But when they grow...
When you say it's a trap, because if they stay
because
in the water, they will die?
They just, yeah.
They die if they stay in the water.
Yeah.
Because there's chemicals in the water,
yeah.
Is it?
Staying in the water, you're getting high.
What?
They are
attracted
by the water, and
yeah.
Their wings get wet.
Yeah, they can fly and just stay there.
It's a past life in Paris.
So, yeah, just wanted to share.
Yeah.
Sometimes the action doesn't...
That's true.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, not knowing, opening, looking at the circumstance, and we don't actually know if our action will be appropriate
away.
In fact, we maybe never know if it's appropriate, but... because there will be consequences, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, for example, made me think of migrants in the Mediterranean, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's save them, they're sentient beings, let's save them. No, but we don't really want those kinds here, so we just leave them there.
Yeah. Exactly, on another level,
yeah,
absolutely.
Difficult choices.
No, we punish the people that try to save them. We're starting to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So be careful. We will come for you.
Well, and then, so it's interesting that these Asian wasps don't have a predator because they're not in their native habitat, right? I mean, and so somehow There was an intervention, and
they have
ended up here. I don't exactly know how they got here, on fruit or something, or what, how did they get here? I don't know.
Boats.
Yeah. Not on migrant boats? Is that that's further motivation to not allow? I'm kidding.
They're probably quite angry that we call them Asian. I think it's a bit racist.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know. Yeah,
just because they have yellow legs.
Yeah, but you see how quickly it goes, right? Really, it goes really fast.
But it's interesting that now they have a kind of predator. It's the pool.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Actually, yeah. Well, and that must happen in their natural habitat too, don't they? They're attracted to water and lakes or swamps or something too. I don't know. But
the greatest things are the bees, because they destroy the whole honeybees. You see, they're very, very aggressive.
Uh-huh.
You can see even they look like wild. Like warriors, when they enter this, there are movies about that, and they are absolutely horrible with the bees. So the bees are the victims. Perhaps you can introduce in your equation, if you want to save more bees than wasps, you see, because they're going to kill bees.
Well, and see, this too is, you know, there's the famous, the fable story of the Buddha in a previous existence on a boat, where there was someone who was going to kill everyone on the boat, and he killed the guy so that he wouldn't kill all the other people on the boat.
So keep up the good work.
This is not a solution, but it's just, it's true, huh? That if, when we open to not knowing, then we see the wider picture too, sometimes.
As I was telling him, the thing is that the poor continental European bees don't know how to defend themselves against these wasps.
Mm.
But in Asia, I think they came from Asia anyway, they know how to do it.
Mm.
They are very clever. The bees, they start in Asia, they start moving their wings, and that makes temperature rising, and they suffocate. It's unbelievable. See, but here the bees don't know how to do it. So they are just victims.
They have not yet learned. Maybe at some point they will learn. I don't know. But
there's no way to educate them. It's true. I'm serious. We have to bring some bees from Asia.
Exactly.
To show them.
Ooh, we might be opening a hornet's nest today. So this is really an interesting tangent, though, because how do we... can we trust as well that, okay, so the without saying, okay, let's bring in these Asian wasps so that these bees will learn how to defend themselves from Asian wasps, no, but can we trust that eventually maybe these bees will learn how to defend themselves? I don't know. I didn't know about these Asian wasps. Do we have them in France?
I'm wondering if there's a confusion between wasps and hornets, because you just mentioned the hornet's nest. So suddenly I realized that was the English word. In France we have frelon asiatique, and that is the bee killer.
Right.
But it's not the size of an average wasp. It's three times as big or something.
Right. Yeah.
So maybe what you're saving is just regular wasps. So that would solve your problem somehow. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe we can check into that. Take action.
They have yellow.
But don't. Yeah, and regular wasps don't have yellow legs.
No.
Okay.
We had that in Coimbra. In Coimbra, in this big tree. This.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know it was those. Okay. I didn't know it was the Asian ones.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think there is a solution. Is invite the Asian bees to come.
that's
the native bees.
That's like, what was it in Australia? They introduced some kind of particular kind of frog for some very precise thing, and now they can't get rid of frogs in Australia. Or you have a situation here in Portugal with eucalyptus trees, right?
Oh, yeah.
Can I have because of taking action, mm-hmm. I thought about perhaps some plants that we can do mm. in the scheme, but then I remember that eucalyptus, it's against mosquitoes. If we can have some, yeah, and put some eucalyptus before the door or mm-hmm. knack mm-hmm. The blades, and it's good for against mosquitoes. Mm-hmm.
But it attracts wasps.
I don't know. It's a little problem, the mosquitoes. Yeah. But it's eucalyptus is
it's
good
true.
Against
yeah.
mosquitoes. You can put before your window
yeah.
and open. I think
there is something that is bothering me. Is like because you know I read what happened with the last boat of the migrants, and you know it's kind of maybe the civil guards. I mean they made something that really.
Yeah.
So we are thinking that maybe they made the boat sink. And the fact
ooh.
Is, I'm sure there
the
were...
The Coast Guard, Greek Coast Guard.
Yeah, and I'm sure, and you know, my problem is that there were, I guess these people, they were taking actions and they were doing the right thing for themselves. I mean, in their mind, they are doing the right thing. So, you know what I mean? That the problem is when you think that you are doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know we are doing the right thing? Because these people are, I mean, what they are doing with the migrants, they are doing it and they know, the, I mean, they think, they decide that what they are doing is the right thing, which is not, from our point of view, which is not. So it's tough because when we decide things like that, how are we to decide that we are doing the right thing? If I see these people acting with the migrants, I'm like, for me, it's not the right thing. You know, it's how do you decide that you are doing the right thing?
Well, that's why we come back to our practice of sitting, cultivating not knowing, cultivating opening to what is here, you know, now in the circumstances. And acting from a place of not me, of not my ego, my opinion, my ideas, my isolated separate self. So if we see that we are not separate from someone who is struggling and needs to be saved at sea, if we see that they are me and I am them, we won't sink them and drown them. If we see them as separate, and I think of my interests and my what I want, what I think is right, even this idea of right, I don't like migrants. I don't think they should come to Greece. I've been given orders that we're not to allow any more in, let them fend for themselves, whatever the reasons. I don't know what the Coast Guard's reasons were. We don't even know if that's exactly what happened, but it looks like it. If we act from that place, then we're not taking into account the whole of life, the oneness of life. We're taking into account, it's a very fragmented way of seeing things and centering it around me. Mm-hmm. And that's where we can have a better chance of doing no harm, because ultimately if we see the oneness of life, we don't want to harm. We wouldn't want to harm, you know, it's like we don't want to harm the baby wasps.
But that's why I think that we have to save the baby wasps, because we don't know what's going to, we don't know exactly if they are the one that are going to kill the other. Well, we don't know, so I think it's, I mean, first thing to is to save them. Thank you. If I, you know.
So then, yes, so then we open it up to, you know, it's things like... antibiotics, for example, that kill in order to save us, right? We take medicine, antibiotics, right? Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we try to limit it as much as possible. But we can say that, in some cases, antibiotics save lives. So we're accepting to kill in order to save. We might say, no, I'm not going to take antibiotics, or I'm not going to allow antibiotics because I'm not. There are Christian sects, and the Christian Scientists, mm-hmm. who deny any sort of medical intervention. Yeah, because they believe that God's divine will take over. And that if someone is supposed to die according to God's divine will, then they will die. We shouldn't intervene with medicine. There's no clear-cut response, you know. Probably if there was a nest in this house, we would probably be more clear what to do. Either we would close up the house and go away. Right, I'm sure there has been, yeah. Or there would be some destruction that would take place of the nest. That's usually what happens. But it's not a clear... And then if we do have to take an action like that, so if Miguel is brought to let the baby wasps die, then we can honor that life that we've taken and respect it and, you know, atone for having taken that life. That's why we chant that chant in the morning of all the suffering that I've created. Now I atone for it. And that means just to be one with it, to acknowledge it, to say I'm sorry, or, you know, it's not really say I'm sorry, but to acknowledge it and be one with it. Say, yes, I did this. And I know why I did it.
And maybe at some point we can act even, I don't know, killing, like the story you told about the boat, without being greedy or with anger. Just doing the appropriate thing to the situation.
That's right.
Although it's morally...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there is a difference between a bee, a wasp, and a human life.
What is that difference?
Think about it.
What's the difference?
The difference between species and mm-hmm. different type of lives. Maybe we have consciousness, the bees don't have consciousness, this kind of...
Well,
we have to make into our evaluation this kind of also issue, no?
We do.
One thing is a human, another is...
We do, and we think that life is worth less than this life.
There's a lot of discussion by now with animal rights. This goes back to the guy called Peter Singer, perhaps you have read this guy, mm-hmm. and he's questioning from a very rationalist point of view, where does this animal rights stop? See, and he's using more or less this kind of argument. Then you have really to take into consideration some kind of hierarchical set of values in which you consider that, after all, yeah, the human being is perhaps more important than fly or something.
Yes,
yeah, sure. But he's trying to discuss this from this more ethical point of view, and this becomes, of course, very, very complicated.
It does, and that's why in our practice is much simpler. If we look into the true nature of I, of this, and we truly experience the true nature of things, the nature of the fly and the wasp and I is
exactly
the same nature. It's just a different manifestation of that nature. And then we can go into studying, yes, one has consciousness or not. And if we then establish that, okay, the difference is that we are aware and we whatever, well then how do we use that awareness?
Mm-hmm.
How do we use that then? How do we respect the other manifestations of myself that don't have that awareness? Or that they have something that I don't have, and how do we then function? It's just different manifestations of the one.
Yeah, but there is always this complicated moment in which you have to act.
Absolutely.
There are stories like that.
Yeah.
Okay, I heard a story once with Suzuki, with this Zen master. That, well, someone once, we were discussing this in a session, and someone brought this story that in the Zen there were a lot of, I don't remember, bugs or something like that, and they were willing to stay with the bugs for 1 day or 2 days, but the second day it seems that Suzuki he himself start killing them, and he said there are moments in which we have to do like that. You see, it was very,
that's right.
I mean, I don't know exactly, I never read the story where someone was telling it, because the circumstances were extreme, you see, but of course how can a Zen master going out and start killing flies like that in the Zendo? This is quite the great koan, I would say.
Yeah, well, it's a fine example of what we've been talking about, of not knowing, bearing witness to the situation, then taking action appropriate to the situation, not being fixed. Another story from Suzuki is of one of his students who had to take him to see a doctor or something, and they had to go a long trip together. And on the way back, the student was telling him, was a strict vegetarian, and was telling him all about how, you know, how important it was, and how people who weren't vegetarian were blind, and they didn't understand, and we can't eat animals, and all of this stuff. And he was so proud of himself that he was vegetarian, and he had mastered vegetarian cooking, and all of this stuff. And they stopped somewhere to eat lunch, and they were walking along, and they walked in front of a cafe or something, and the guy said, oh, there's probably nothing in there to eat, so they walked on, and they ended up having to go back to the cafe. Suzuki wanted to go to the cafe. So they went to the cafe, and the student, the only thing on the menu he could eat was a grilled cheese sandwich, which is kind of like a croque monsieur in French without meat in it. I think you have croque monsieur here too, no? Portuguese? In Portugal? No, you call it something else. That's right, yeah. And that was the only thing on the menu he could eat. And Suzuki Roshi got this big hamburger. And and so, you know, with fries and the whole thing. And so then they started eating, and the guy said, so how is it, you know? And Suzuki said, oh, it's delicious, it's really good, how is yours? And he said, it's good, it's a good grilled cheese, you know? Suzuki said, oh, can I try it? And the guy said, sure, yeah, try it. And he gave him, of course, he's not going to tell his teacher he can't try his sandwich. So he takes a bite of it, and Suzuki said, oh, that's better than mine. And he switched the plates. So he ate the grilled cheese, and the guy was like stuck. I can't remember. Do you know the story? You seem like you know it.
He's told me before.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember if he ate the cheeseburger or not. So we're so attached. We get so attached to our positions, and Suzuki probably, you know, maybe in this case of killing the bugs, it could maybe even have been like, he probably didn't want a cheeseburger, Suzuki Roshi, but he saw this as a great teaching opportunity to help his student let go of his attachments. And maybe the same thing with killing all those flies or whatever the bugs were in the Zendo, it was an opportunity to awaken, accepting to sacrifice the lives of those bugs for the greater awakening of his student, not greater in the sense that they're better, but that then the students would then kill less eventually or something, I don't know. So you see where this simple sitting on the cushion and entering into the practice of not knowing, you see where it takes us. It's just, wow, it takes us into the universe and back. And then into very, you know, very simple, basic actions of killing the mosquito or not. You know, walking in our kinhin, we're probably killing you know, hundreds and thousands of insects and little beings by walking in the grass or walking on the... and we're not even thinking about it. Maybe we can pay a little bit more attention. Doesn't mean we won't go out walking outside, but just be aware of it.
Yes, but it's not intention. There's no intention to kill.
No,
when there is
true.
Intention, it's...
Right. So sometimes, though, the you know, like the people, some of the German people who acted on Hitler's orders said, well, I was just following orders. I wasn't intending to do that.
Well, don't you think that could be active in the case that Claudia was talking about? These guys are saying, we are doing this for the better good of Greek society, not just, I want to go out and maul somebody, but
yeah, probably.
This is the correct response to this problem.
Probably, yeah.
Which is even worse, but still.
Right. I don't know. It's not even really clear exactly what happened.
Yeah,
but.
I think that the attitude of these people, because it's a lot of happenings like that, but it's more like, you know, most of the times the migrants, they are on the two zones, and nobody wants to help them because they say, no, this is on the over,
right.
on the over coast, and say, no, this is the overs, and at the end, nobody is going to save them.
Yeah.
So it's not really to kill them on purpose, but it's like something like,
it's not my zone,
they will do it. And at the end, nobody is doing it, and it's tragic.
Well, and then as we saw at the same time that was happening, and we've all read about this, there was the little vessel that was sinking in the bottom and disappeared, the bottom of the ocean, you know, with five people on board, five multimillionaires. And all we see that, so like this also is on not only an individual level, but on a cultural level of really, of course, all of the attention the media was focusing on that little vessel, they were not intending to do harm to the migrants. They weren't intending to focus only on that. But that, the way that the conditioning and the way that our culture is constructed, is that we don't pay attention to certain things and we pay attention to others.
And they spend so much money to save these people.
Right.